had the chance to walk over the half there with Donuts, would you take it?
Yeah.
What do a stewardess, a gunrunner, a bail bondsman, an ex-con, a federal agent, and a beach bunny have in common?
You don't come in on this thing with me. You got to be prepared to go all the way.
They're all chasing a half million in cash.
Wouldn't be missed.
Half $1 million will always be missed.
Pam Grier, Samuel L. Jackson, Robert Forster, Bridget Fonda, Michael Keaton, and Robert De Niro.
Is she dead?
I.
Yes or no? Is she dead?
Pretty much.
Quentin Tarantino's Jackie Brown.
Welcome back to the Mad About Movies VIP Club. Now here's one of your hosts, Kent, Brian, or Richard.
What's going on, ma'am fam? It's not just the VIP, it's the whole crew, the whole Motley crew, all those kind of plebes and scum of non-VIP fans. That's what we call you guys. We're in the VIP right. Feed, obviously. Are here. We're doing a little preview here on the main feed. Just kidding. We love all of our listeners. But this will be fun. We'll kind of give you a little preview of what's going on. Extra episode every week in addition to what we normally put out. So we normally do these at the throwback variety. And this is part of our series this year, discussing and ranking the films of one Mr. Quentin Tarantino. We've done a few other types of series in the past. We've done the Harry Potters and The Office. We've done Seinfeld. We've done all the Avengers saga. And now we are doing the films of Quentin Tarantino. And good timing we have here because there is some Tarantino news in the news. Because of, and a lot of people don't know this, Bill Clinton, when Reservoir Dogs first came out in 1992, well, I guess it was still President Bush then, but President Clinton carried it out that Tarantino was to only make 10 films.
Right.
This was an executive order. Mm-hmm. No one knows why. And because of that, he's on his 10th film, and he's being extra precious about what that 10th film is. And he's been talking about the sort of summation of his entire film being this film called The Movie Critic, which will be about kind of a 70s, all the films that are so influenced Mr. Tarantino. And there's even rumors that he was going to like recreate classic scenes within the movie. So it'd be like the grandest homage of the master of homage. But anyway, this last week, he has decided it is not up to par with what will be his last movie and has since scrapped the project. So there's no way he could make 11. There's just no way. Again, he would be executed on the spot by military tribunal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
So, and that's a bummer because I think it'd be great if we could get 11 Tarantino movies. I think we'd all like that. But unfortunately,
sorry, man. I don't mean to interrupt you, but I did a little Googling, just fact checking as I do. Mm-hmm. And that didn't happen actually. So he could make 40 movies if he wanted to.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I know, it's weird.
Make 10?
Yeah, I was under that same impression. I thought at least it was like a Bush era thing, but mm-hmm. it's not. That's sort of
Patriot Act.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a Mandela.
So it's self-imposed
situation that we're dealing with. Yeah,
got
but
it.
No, nobody told him he's legally not allowed to make an 11th or 12th or 37th film. This is solely his own thing. This limit that he's put on himself.
Okay.
Crazy.
Well, so he's not making The Movie Critic.
right.
It's a bummer. This sounded like a really cool project. The cast was, we didn't have like full official cast, but everything we had was as close to that as possible. And it sounded awesome. And in a world that you would think Tarantino would thrive in, especially after exploring Hollywood a bit with his past movie. And now we don't know. So I talked to Kent a little bit about this. We were at a concert on the day it all hit. So I got some initial Kent thoughts. But Kent, has anything changed since you and I last chatted it up about this topic? Do you think Once Upon in Hollywood may be his last movie and he wants to go out with that one?
That's kind of what we were talking about. Mm-hmm. It was, if he decides I'm done making movies, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood's a pretty good ender to what has been his career. It, you know, summarizes it in a lot of ways. Go back and listen to our episode on that, or stick around in the VIP later this year when we revisit it for this retrospective series we're doing. But I've done a little more research on it, and actually there was a big piece today that dropped on the Hollywood Reporter that kind of details this a little bit more. And from what I can gather on this, it seems like he's not out on making another movie. It's just not going to be The Movie Critic. Mm. I think that's what
Yeah, I think he's definitely making a 10th movie. That's what I was telling you last week. I don't think he's going out with Hollywood.
Apparently, Sony is on board to make whatever he comes up with, and they've said he has a lot of other ideas. I'm willing to bet he has 5 or 10 like full scripts that he's just done and never gotten to the point of wanting to make them into movies that are probably really good. You know, maybe one of those ideas is piquing his interest a little more. Maybe it makes more sense now. I still have hope. So eventually,
he's definitely making another one. I just wanted to,
you know, whenever that is.
I just wanted this one. It sounded so cool.
Yeah, it did. Mm-hmm. And apparently, according to this published today on the Hollywood Reporter, it was going to be so meta that he was going to maybe, this is just rumor, that he was going to maybe go back to some of his movies. As if they were 70s, like as if Pulp Fiction was a 70s movie or something, and bring back like his own characters in certain ways. Because I know that, I think Brad Pitt was going to be Cliff Booth in the movie.
Right.
Once Upon a Time in Oz. So maybe it was going to be like this big, not just homage to Hollywood, but to himself in a lot of ways. Maybe that whole concept, he's like, no, maybe that's not how I should... do this.
Yeah, apparently there was even a note in there that apparently it was possible that the characters were going to bump into a young Tarantino as a film usher at a theater. Mm-hmm. So that could have been a thing as well. It's weird. I'm of two minds on this. I'm curious what you guys' thoughts are. Number one, I think he's in his head a little bit. This whole I'm only doing 10 movies and then I'm out kind of thing. It seems like he's putting a lot of pressure on himself that this one has to be like his masterpiece. And I would say you've probably made a masterpiece or three already, my friend. So it's all right if this one's an A-, probably. But also, if you've got 20 movies in you, you can make 20 movies. It's okay.
It feels like a mistake to announce it before. It feels like Seinfeld saying, it's going to be the last season of Seinfeld, and they haven't written any of the episodes. And all the writers are just stressing for months trying to like, oh man, this better be good. You know,
it's very odd.
The season and they can kind of flow into it. Yeah. Don't put the pressure on yourself like that. It's insane.
I fully, all those things I'm with. The flip side is, it also kind of sounds like this was going to be terrible. So I, I have full faith. If there's anybody as a writer that I have faith in, like, taking sort of an insane project and being, and then at the end of the day, us being like, wow, that came together. I don't know how. Obviously, I think, obviously it's Tarantino. It seemed like he had a really good idea that he then maybe tried to cross over with a lot of other ideas, maybe all of which are very good. Just reading that thing today, I was like, this might have been a good thing that he scrapped this, because this sounds like a very high degree of difficulty kind of thing to keep us all from being like, hey, I love Tarantino, but like, that was rough, right? Like, that was that was very tough. Also sounded like the studio, Kent, was like, hey, we're in the business of Tarantino. We'll do whatever you want to do. But that also, they were like, okay, cool. We don't have to do that one. Awesome. Yeah. That's good. Interesting. So I did not expect to feel that way until I read that story, that report today. And I was like, okay, I think I'm on his side here. This is a good idea to not do this one, probably.
Yeah.
But he's created the situation that makes him feel like he can't make this movie at the same time. So,
which is maybe also was kind of his point. Right. In his defense was like, you know, if you only have 10 movies to make, I'll never make a bad one because I'll just wait. I won't have the sad end of career that a lot of directors have. So, I mean, in some ways, this makes his argument. If he had infinite movies to make, maybe he just goes ahead and makes this one. And then it's bad or whatever. So so maybe the 10 films is a good idea. But again, Kent and I were talking about the other night at the concert. It's like, there's just not that many original great writer directors, so it's just a bummer that one has put this governor on his work.
Also what we were talking about last episode that we talked to Tarantino, which was Pulp Fiction last month, and saying how he has just an incredible ability to be a movie critic in his own right and to be able to tell if something's gonna be great. And when he says it's gonna kill, and when he says I got a great part for you, and he's talking to an actor, he really means I got a great part for you. So maybe it's that too. Maybe he just, when you step back and look at it as a movie, yeah, didn't meet his standard. And that, you got to commend that for him to be able to do that.
Absolutely. It is commendable. And so let's hope it was that. I hope it, I hope it wasn't just, like to Brian's point earlier, this one has to be an A triple plus and this one's only a B plus. So I'm out because it's my 10th movie. It's like, okay, I hope it wasn't that. I hope it was like, oh, this has potential to be a catastrophe and then it'll be my last movie. Oh my God, I'll do something else. I hope
what would
it,
be I your dream of his third movie? Like subject wise. I mean, 10th movie.
Sci-fi.
Okay, cool.
Not Star Trek, but like his version of sci-fi would be cool.
Yeah, that'd be cool. I liked this premise. I thought it was going to be an interesting movie until today when it was like, oh, this is the most meta movie. Okay, I'm not sure I love that. I liked that a lot. Sci-fi would be cool. Maybe a musical that we don't know is a musical until we get in the theater. That'd be cool.
That's a real popular
that's
thing
hot
now.
Right now. So
I would like to see him make a meta movie about making movies too. I think he could do that well.
I want to see him make a kids movie. I think it would be really funny if he was like, I'm going to make a PG movie for kids.
Yeah.
And just try to see how he could, if he could make, like figure out how to do
well,
that.
Well, he's got really like a, basically a newborn at this point. Like,
yeah.
Maybe that's something that interests him in the next few years.
Just a really fast talking animated dinosaur would be
Stranger Things have happened.
Okay. Yeah. It's like, oh, and then the dinosaur has really hot feet.
Right. I thought the idea of doing Kill Bill 3 with Maya Hawke was a great idea.
I do
maybe
yeah.
Maya Hawke. Return to that. Well, but who knows?
Whatever you're in for, sir, we're certainly interested in it. Good, bad, or indifferent, but hopefully good. Okay, so now it is time to slip back in our retrospective. Again, we do these one of these every year on the show in the VIP feed. That's not all what the VIP feed is. It's also a lot of throwbacks throughout the year, mostly throwbacks, and it's mostly on like anniversaries. So things that are on their 10th, 20th, 25th, 30th, 5th anniversary. A lot of movies we haven't done before are available here on the VIP feed. And then on top of that, we do a retrospective every year. You go to badaboutmoviespodcast.com/VIP. It's also a great Discord full of movie fans, just like you, chatting up with us and each other all day or day. So got that plugged out. But this is kind of just to give everyone a little preview of what we're doing this year in this retrospective. Talking about Tarantino, and this month's film within this retrospective is Jackie Brown. The definitely the cool kid choice for favorite Tarantino movie. Probably until Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, this was like always everyone's. You know, that's actually his best movie. that was a take everyone had to have for a
guilty as charged. Yeah,
yeah. also in the period in the 90s where, you know, how we always joke about the indie station here has to have the tax of every 11 songs has to be reggae. There was a rule in the 90s that a lot of people don't know about it, in addition to the Clinton limiting Tarantino's films, was that every director had to make an Elmore Leonard adaptation. Mandatory.
Right. Or again, you could choose which one, but it had to be done.
Short story or novel, by the way. You don't have to just stick to So
this Brian said Get Shorty's his favorite. Why? Because of John Travolta?
Yeah. That's what you're saying before?
That character and Be Cool specifically.
Yeah, I was going to say you're mostly a Be Cool guy.
It's the Vince Vaughn factor. Yeah.
For sure. Huge Be Cool guy. Be Cool Nation.
Be Cool.
Cool in the gang. Hashtag Cool in the gang. That's Brian's group that hangs out and watches Be Cool every week.
Cool in the gang. That's a great idea for a pod right there. We just Be Cool every week. Cool in the gang.
Every week watching Be Cool.
So... Quentin Tarantino's Jackie Brown, starring your Pam Greers, your Robert De Niro's, your Michael Keaton's, and the like. I will throw to, I threw to Kent first earlier on the other one. So I'll throw to you, Brian, first. First question here. Oh, the other thing we're doing on this retrospective this year, if you're new to this, we have a discussion guide. So all of these movies, we will have the same kind of conversation in terms of the same questions, but they'll guide us in different ways. But there will be kind of a consistent guide, rather, throughout all these movies. So, Brian, first, when did you see this movie?
This was probably pre-Kill Bill. So probably like mid-college, I would guess, something like that. or maybe late high school. I do remember having conversations with people when Kill Bill came out. There was a lot of, at least within like my friend group or whatever, like, man, this is going to be so cool. And it's, you know, it's the guy that did Pulp Fiction, because, you know, not the most educated film people, but also it was a different time and all that kind of stuff. And I was like, yeah, but like, he did Jackie Brown too. I don't know, you know, I probably was the guy that was like, actually, Jackie Brown's the better film if you're really paying attention, you know. I don't totally feel that way now, though. I'll save my rankings for the end of this. But yeah, I watched this probably late high school and I really dug it. I think of his early, of his first probably five films, this is the one that is most like my speed, you know, like made for me, as opposed to, as we talked about Pulp Fiction last month, it's a great movie, a movie that I recognize as being a great movie, maybe even a masterpiece that I don't always vibe with, certainly not like 100% of the time throughout the course of the movie. You know, this one is a lot closer to that. It is kind of my speed. So I really dug this movie a lot. This definitely was my favorite Tarantino movie for a fair stretch. And it's a fun revisit. I will tell you guys, we did it. So most of Tarantino's movies we have reviewed at some point in the past. This was the most recent one. I did a thing for the first time and maybe ever. I went back and listened to our Jackie Brown episode from December of 22, which was cool because I found out that Kent's actually been publishing these things. I had no idea.
Okay, cool.
Up to that point. So that was pretty wild. But yeah, I went back and listened just because it was like, that was so recently that I kind of want to remember what we talked about, just so I don't, you know, say the exact opposite of what I said like a year and a half ago. But yeah, we had an interesting conversation about that, about this movie fairly recently. And, again, without, I don't want to give away my ranks because that's important to the study guide at the end of this thing. But my thoughts remain the same as they were when we reviewed it a year and a half ago. This is a very, very good movie that I like a whole lot. And it's cool to see Tarantino kind of play in somebody else's sandbox a little bit or with their material and stuff. So I dig it. I really like this movie. But what about you guys? What was the first interaction with Jackie Brown?
Kent, you go ahead.
Yeah, same. I think I saw it around the same time as Kill Bill. Don't know if it was before or after, but it was around that time that I became, you know, into Tarantino's work and wanted to make sure I got it all. This was always my least favorite until I became an adult. And then yeah, I was like, totally. Oh, man, this is like the most dad movie of a lot of them, maybe, where it's just cool dudes being cool. Cool chicks being cool, some really cool music along the way, everyone's just hanging out being cool the whole time. It's not overly violent, it's not overly anything, which is surprising for Tarantino. It's kind of his most reserved movie in a lot of ways,
for sure.
I think Kill Bill was just the culmination of like all of his quirks and things that he likes, putting them all into one movie and doing it in the most extreme way. Pulp Fiction's way more like that than this. So this was a hard one for me to come around on, but once I did, each and every time that I watch it, I've loved it more. So one of the better third acts, I think, of a Tarantino movie.
Yeah, for sure.
It's not as like, doesn't go like full operatic like a lot of his too. It's like a really interesting.
It's just so creatively put together.
Yeah, so same for me. I saw that right around Kill Bill, around that time. It's a movie I really like as well. Obviously, we've done an episode on it not too long ago, so I'll stay away from those thoughts. It's one of my favorites as well. It's so restrained, and I like all of that because I think it's truly he's playing with that Leonard material, but also, you know, it's also such a smart career move because, and I don't know how. He might have just really wanted to make this movie. But like when you look at it in the scope of his career, and he is someone that obviously gives a lot of thought to that, his legacy, as we just discussed with the 10 movie rule. You know, it's such a smart decision to say, hey, I've done these two hyper stylized movies in a row, and even kind of like three or four if you count screenplays he sold, right? Natural Born Killers and True Romance. Okay, I'm the guy that does these.
Yeah,
Dust Till Dawn, yeah. Producing and acting in that before this, I think, or same year. And
okay, I do kind of genre, you know, whether they're like French New Wave or kind of quasi-noir, hyper-violent, super comic kind of detached dialogue and really, really slick and quick and all those things. And also, the next thing I'm going to do is a samurai movie with every pop culture thing in it ever that's going to be in two parts and like be animated for 15 minutes and blah, 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 blah. But I want to make a movie in between those. So what do I do, you know? And it's like, it's again, I don't know how intentional he was with it. It might have just been happenstance, but it's like such a smart little deep breath in the middle of that run. To be like, oh, I'm just going to do this cool crime kind of hangout movie that's just noir and slow. Mm-hmm. And like to your point, it's just cool people being cool. I'm going to do the Tarantino thing where I cast Pam Grier. But other than that, it's just going to write some pretty good dialogue for like Robert De Niro and Samuel L. Jackson and Michael Keaton and Pam Grier to all say. But it's not like super self-referential. Doesn't have like a whole jag about Madonna in it. And it's just going to be a good adult, not even really thriller, just kind of drama. And I think that's such a smart choice. Again, whether intentional or not, it's such a good breaking point in his career. Where looking back, you know, man, he's really smart to do that.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite moves for him through his career. I'm with you. Like, I don't know if that was totally planned the way it turned out. I'm going to choose to believe it was because it's a brilliant spot to just hunker down and do sort of a slow burn, hard boiled detective kind of movie almost, you know, and let actors act and just be.
And not every character is some version of him, right?
Exactly. Yes.
They're like really distinct characters.
Yeah. Because it really does, it gives you a place that you can kind of point to. Because I don't know that he was ever going to, I think he has shown, let me put it this way. I think he has shown since this point that he is, he does have more range and he can do different things. This was like a nice little stop down where you could always point to it. He does this. This is what the Tarantino move is. And you could say, but he did Jackie Brown. And you were like, yeah, it's true. I can't really, there's nothing I could say against Jackie Brown, honestly, as an adult, you know, I totally get what you were saying, Kent, of, you know, as a kid or as a teen or whatever, it feels different and maybe was disappointing to some people. Maybe that's why everybody in my dorm hall was like, I don't even think about Jackie Brown because it wasn't what these things were. But when you look at his career from let's say 90 to 2009 or 2008, this kind of sticks out. It doesn't stick out like a sore thumb. It sticks out as like a, hey, by the way, he did this. Like he can do this in addition to this thing that you're kind of saying that's all he does, you know.
Very recent reference I'm going to make here. Pulp Fiction was Golden Hour, and this is Star-Crossed.
Yeah.
Okay.
Where it's still great, but you do it to maintain your artistic credibility.
Yeah. Mm. It's the saltine between
the food. To show everyone that you're not a one-hit wonder, that you aren't a one-note type of person, director, do different tones, different styles, but still be you. And then you can go to Kill Bill and play the hits, you know, come back with Deeper Well.
Or even go even more like insane, stylized, insane, personal. Mm. Like these are my unique fetishes almost to the point. Yeah. And I'm going to make a movie about that. If that comes after Pulp Fiction, it's still great. Kill Bill's awesome and so cool and so well-made and so action-packed, and we can't wait to talk about it in a month. But, you know, if that comes after Pulp Fiction, there's a lot of people like, geez, this guy really loves himself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's having that come after Jackie Brown, it's like, oh, man, Tarantino is doing this thing again after that great little, remember that little drama he made a couple years ago? It's so smart. To that point, getting back into in this one on the discussion guide, because this one isn't necessarily quintessential Quentin, a couple of these might be a little difficult to ask, but for the sake of consistency, we're going to keep doing it. What is the most necessary Tarantinoan scene, right? It's very Quentin. It's very, you know, what you think about when you think of his aesthetic or voice or whatever style, but it's necessary to the movie. Kent, what's yours?
Yeah, I have two answers here. I'll go with the first chronological answer, which is the first sequence with Beaumont, Chris Tucker, and Samuel L. Jackson hyping him up to go kill somebody. Yeah. And then the shot with, I guess it's like a parking lot security cam type shot of him just pulling in and killing Beaumont. Love that. Because you don't see it coming, and it's very Quentin when it's like, oh, anyone can die at any moment. It's going to come when you least expect it. It's going to be in a real stylized way. Yeah. That's really the only moments like that in the movie, though.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He gets it out of the way right away.
Yeah.
Also
right,
smart.
Right.
What about you, Brian?
That's a good one, Kent. I think for me, it's probably the first scene with Samuel Jackson and Robert De Niro in the apartment with the
watching the TV show
Guns and Girls.
That was really one of mine too.
Yeah, because you get this major. It's not just the Tarantino-y-ness of it. It's in terms of like the video and the girls and all that kind of stuff. You learn everything you need to know about Samuel Jackson's character there, and sort of as an addendum to that, you kind of get what you need to know about De Niro and Bridget Fonda. So it's kind of, it's almost a pointer scene in a way, but it's done so
he's really
well
good at
because,
that.
Yeah, he's incredible. Maybe the best. He might be the best.
It's the Royale with cheese scene of the movie.
Yep.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah, it sets a lot of stuff up in a very entertaining, dialogue-heavy sequence, but with, you know, kind of a Tarantino style to it. There's not a lot of style to this movie. A lot of Tarantino style to this movie. There's style just because it's sort of classic noirness and stuff like that. But yeah, that to me, that's probably the moment, the scene.
Yeah, mine too. Bridget Fonda, by the way, it's great. Great in this. Remember her? Yeah, I was going to say, he's the master of like exposition, but done by not talking about like the plot, but it's like he really sets everything up really well, like character exposition or like, you know, their point of view, what's gonna matter later on because of nonsense early on in the movie, right? And yeah, I now know everything I need to know about their personalities, points of view, and everything, and now I'm gonna let the actor take it from there. So that's definitely mine. Okay, Brian, I'll go to you first on this one. What's the most unnecessary Tarantino in scene?
I don't think there is one. Like this is his most restrained movie. And we talked a little bit in Pulp Fiction about how good he is at restraining the movie, his movie, like almost to the point of like explosion before that actually happens, before he does have an explosion of action and stuff like that. Maybe you guys have something. I don't have a good answer for this one. There doesn't feel like there's much of anything here that is over the top or gratuitous or just a little too much to me. It feels like pretty much everything is in keeping with, what it should be. I'll tell you what it could be though. And I was looking at my notes from when we did this a couple years ago. He offered the role of Winston to Shaq, and that probably would have been okay. I'm at this time Shaq was acting and stuff, or had come off of some acting.
So steel.
Why
steel
would Shaq have said no?
I don't know. I didn't see anything on that. I mean, and maybe the role was bigger in the script because it's, I mean, you know, that guy's in the movie for two scenes basically. I don't know, but that I could definitely see us watching this, you know, 25 years on and being like, I mean, I love Shaq. Everyone loves Shaq. Q rating on that guy is through the roof, but maybe it would feel like a commercial for The General, you know, instead of anything else here.
All right, I'll give mine. Mine's quick, so before I throw it to you, Kent. Mine is just, so I'm with you. There's not really one. It's just Tarantino being the voice on the answering machine.
Oh, yeah, that's fair.
Forcing himself in there. At least he didn't, you know, end mom on it or anything, so that's good. That's a win. progress. But yeah, that would be mine. Kent, what's your most unnecessary Tarantino moment?
This might be cheating, looking ahead on the rundown we have here for the show, but it cross-sections with Best Feet, and it's just
let's save it for Best Feet then
or transition to Best Feet where it's Bridget Fonda.
Okay, let's just go
very Tarantino-y.
Okay. I was gonna say the really only feet in it,
that's the character building moment for her. It's like, let's zoom in on the feet. She's got some toe rings.
Yeah, she does,
you know, painted nails. It's like, yeah, learn a lot about someone through their feet, according to Quentin.
Yep, dialogue early and then lots of feet. Yeah, Bridget Fonda, it's like, it's really weird. She just disappeared for a long time, and then you realize she's got to stare down Danny Elfman's weird body all the time. So she's probably just in trauma.
My wife was watching this with me and walked in the room and was like, is that Bridget Fonda? And then went on a Wikipedia deep dive, and we started laughing when we found out she was married to Danny Elfman. It was a great moment.
Stuck through him through, I think he got me too a few times the last couple of years, but you know. Okay, next up on the discussion guide here, Kent. Any other feat, by the way, you want to bring up, Brian?
No, that's okay. That's the feat of this movie.
All right, yep, done. You got to ask it. It's on the discussion guide. Okay, next up we'll go to coolest needle job. This one has some great ones. We all know Quentin writes these movies a lot of times to the music. That's kind of the first thing picked out to set the mood, and this one has some awesome jams on it. So, Kent, I'll go to you first. Coolest needle job.
Yeah, this might be his best soundtrack.
Yeah, it's so sick.
It is greatness. Yeah. I mean, Pulp Fiction is obviously incredible, but this one, just the depth of the B-sides and stuff that he pulled out for this one is awesome. The references are great.
I wish he'd write a music book next, by the way. I think that'd be awesome.
Yeah, that would be awesome. Music podcast or something would be great, yeah.
Yeah.
The one I'm going to pick is overused. It's Sissy Strut from The Meters. It's used like 3 or 4 times in the movie. I don't know why he keeps using it, but it's such a cool tune and it's very Tarantino-y. So love that one. But I mean, I love the opening across 110th Street, how he opens and closes with that. It's awesome.
What about you, Brian?
That one's mine. That's a very basic answer, but it feels like the right one here. It's in the movie like 3 or 4 times. It is, you know, it is the bookends of the movie. It's so cool at the last one, especially as you know, they sit in the car contemplating,
like lyrically describing what's happening to perfectly.
Yes. Yeah. It's so cool. It's so cool. It's a great, it's a great song. It is a great needle drop. And to use it, I think a lot of movies have and will continue to overuse a song, you know, over the history of the movies we've reviewed in here. That one is like, yeah, he uses it a few times, and every time like, heck yeah, bro, this is great. It's it's a perfect song, a perfect match for the movie, and used quite well.
All right. For me, I like the, just because it's, you expect a certain type of like cool 70s, soul, some vintage songs, some noir stuff. And I love the Johnny Cash Tennessee Stud, just cause it's so out of place and so unique and so random in the movie, and works great. Mm.
What do you think about the Delphonics song being picked? And it's such an integral part of the, you know, what Max Cherry and her bond over that song, and it's kind of, he goes to I love the scene of him going to the tape store and buying it and listening to it in his car and stuff. I mean, that could have been any song, right? Do you think that fits the moment?
No, absolutely. I think it's cool. I mean, he has such an eye for, or ear rather, for not only the music, but the timing of when they hit and building the, you know, he and Sally Menke. They have such a great way of working those songs at the exact right time, where they're always hit like right in the gut. So they don't work.
In his scripts, when, speaking of editing, when there's so many cool insert shots in this movie, like I wonder how he knows to get that stuff on set.
I know.
Like how he thinks, I need a shot of the finger rolling up the window in the car. Like things like that are just so quick.
Yeah. But
he has such a great eye for that, I mean, it probably took 4 hours to get that one shot to set up the camera over the car and do the whole thing. You know, I mean, that's like
one thing that would be really cool is, because Brian and I both read that Devil's Candy book recently, thanks to his recommend. And then I read the Coppola book about Apocalypse Now and all that. And like, one thing I would love for Quentin to do, because he's such a personality, such a pain in the butt in so many ways, but obviously so talented, is let a really good writer just like all in on the process. From like someone just gets to hole up with him, because I think he loves the history of movies so much. It would be so cool. Like, let's say he makes the movie, whatever he's going to make in 2 years, and then the book comes out about making it 3 years later. Yes. That this person was like, I was there from the minute he thought of it till the premiere, hanging out, listening, watching his process. I think that'd be so. He's the one director. Yeah, there's like other directors I like a little bit more than Quentin. He's definitely near the top of my list, but I'm not, he's not my number one ever, but he's definitely my number one. I'm like, I would love to read a 600 page book about him making a movie, because you know it would be like wild.
And you know, he wouldn't be able to stop himself from giving too much, you know. It would just be...
That's what's great about... And De Palma is his hero. That's writer,
exactly. Yeah, yeah. He'd send the writer away and then be like, you know what? Never mind. And have to like go track her down. Like, hey, so... And just give more information.
Right.
You know? Or it's 2 a.m. and they're rapping or something. And he's like, I need to talk. And just going on and on.
Every story about Quentin is like, I showed up to his house at 11 p.m. and I didn't leave till 6 a.m.
Yeah.
He's up all night talking. That's every interaction with him.
Totally. And now he's like in Tel Aviv half the time and stuff. Like there's so much there that would be fascinating. And like, that's what's great about the De Palma book, who's, you know, his, one of his real heroes, is like, there's so many like little side notes of like that the author will be like, in De Palma, you know, he's really struggling that day because of a breakup he had a year ago and he really wanted to have kids and she didn't. And you're like, geez, he told this lady everything.
Right.
Like it's written as kind of just like an aside about this other project why he couldn't be at the edit that day. But then you're like, Brian's going through it, man. He's telling this journalist about breakups from 4 years ago.
A total stranger, basically. Yeah.
On that note, I kind of want him to write his autobiography and just tell all everything.
He's a great writer.
I'm down for that too. But yeah, but I would love to have somebody else's inside perspective as they try to like distill everything that he tells them. Yeah.
That would be awesome. Okay. So next up, next question we've got here is favorite piece of dialogue or monologue in the movie. This is some of his least showy writing. Brian, I'll go to you first on this one.
So Ordell has two of the best lines in the movie. The one that everybody kind of remembers about the AK-47s and then the one that he said, what he says to De Niro right after he shot him is fantastic as well. My personal favorite, and I think it's because the thing maybe that I enjoy most about this movie is the Robert Forster, Pam Grier relationship and interactions and stuff. That is like a part of almost unique in the Tarantino filmography, is like that kind of a relationship. Mm-hmm. Like there's just not a lot of that in his movies, but when they're talking and he no emotion, very calmly says, well, $500,000 will always be missed. It's just such, it's like sort of the culmination of their plan, their whole thing that they're about to get into, mm-hmm. and the relationship that they have. And Forster delivers it so cool too.
Yeah,
and
Forster's so cool.
He's so freaking good in this movie, dude. And Pam Grier, we talked about this when we did our review a couple years ago. Like, it's a crime that she wasn't nominated for an Oscar for this. Forster was nominated, and he 1,000,000,000% deserved it. He's remarkable in this thing. And the way the two of their interaction is so cool. And I love that. I love that line this time around.
Yeah. What were those 98? I need to get those nominations.
The biggest disadvantage this movie had at the time, which is kind of why it flew under the radar for a lot of people, they released it, I think, the same day as Titanic. It was Christmas 1997. I mean, for just months, all anyone was talking about was Titanic. The Oscars, all they were talking about was Titanic. So terrible foresight from, you know, Weinstein Company or whoever was doing it back then on not seeing the the machine that Titanic was gonna be
for sure.
The awards.
So many people missed it, but Weinstein's probably should have. I'm sure they did some horrible things to try to beat it. Robin Williams won that year over Forrester for Good Will Hunting. That's right,
which is great. I mean, he's great in that. That one's not nearly like I brought this up on the episode, but your leading actress nominees that year were Helen Hunt for As Good As It Gets, Kate Winslet for Titanic, and then Helena Bonham Carter for Wings of the Dove, Judy Christie for Afterglow, and Dame Judi Dench for Mrs. Brown. Like this, with respect to all three of them who are great actresses, there's no world. There's just no world. I'm sorry. That's pretty
brutal. Yeah, that's one where we probably just kick it to next year.
Quentin said he was super disappointed she didn't get nominated because when he met with her for the part, she was like, oh, I'm doing great. I've got Escape from LA coming out. I'm about to be in Mars Attacks. And he was like, no, just wait. I got something.
Right.
Like, it's going to be like, trust me.
Yeah.
And
he did get a SAG nom, which is
I mean, geez, man. It's such a great character on the page. My favorite sequence is actually, I think that same one, Brian, where Cherry just shows up to her apartment for coffee and they just hang out and talk for 15 minutes. I love that sequence. The blocking of it, the way it's shot, the way it's written out, the character development. It's awesome.
I love two characters having a coffee, talking.
Yeah.
Like one of my favorite. If it's done
such
right.
Such a great moment where so she's like, come in for coffee. And he's like, well, if you're making some, you know, he's like, you know, it's like, oh, this is going to be awesome. Great scene.
For sure. So frequently can be a thing where you're like, hey, that could be, that's probably what needs to be cut in this 2.5 hour movie.
Yeah.
And it's very rarely the case with Tarantino. It's certainly not the case here. The other one that's great, and I don't mean, this will not be yours, Richard, I'm sure, because it's not really a line. It's just more of a moment, is the when he's talking about how about hanging up the bail bondsman thing, and the interaction that they have while he's explaining, well, I was waiting for this guy to come home, and she asks him like 3 or 4 questions, and it's just such a smooth conversation between two people. Like, she lightly interrupts him, he casually answers her question, continues his story, she interjects, he answers her question, continues the story. It's like such a cool and I don't know what song's playing in the background or what the score is there, but it's just loud enough to where it's like it's adding to the rhythm of this conversation that they're having. It really is some of his best writing and some of the best acting within his writing like that.
Man, Robert Forster, I know people were saying when he cast Pam Grier, oh, you know, she's going to be the Travolta of this movie, where it's going to revive her, you know, 70s stardom and stuff. People should have been more worried about Robert Forster, because I saw this. I was like, is this guy Cary Grant? I mean, he's that good, you know? Why isn't he James Bond? I mean, it's unbelievable.
Didn't even have an agent at the time. Like,
yeah.
Tarantino kind of had to track him down to get him this script. And that's
big
that's,
diner guy. I heard when he died a few years ago, they hung out the same diner in LA every day. So that rocks. Robert Forster, all time dudes rock guy. Yeah. There's so many Ordell lines that are great. Ordell is sort of sui generis of Leon Black in a lot of ways. Like in the lines, he's like, you know, my ass may be dumb, but I'm no dumbass. Things like that. That's a very Leon kind of line. So there's a lot of his stuff that's gold and very quippy and silly. One that's really good is like Max's line of like, you know, a good cop will never let you know when he knows you're blank, you know, when you're full of it. I don't know. I always think of that as like a great cool kind of cop line. So that's my favorite.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Okay. I'll go first on this one. Most cinematic shot or best piece of action. Again, kind of a slow burn, but there's some in it really a beautifully shot movie in a lot of ways. I love all the stuff on the plane. I think it's so cool.
Yeah,
it's like
great
plane stuff. So I'll lay claim the plane. What about what about you, Kent?
I love the entire last sequence at the department store.
It's awesome.
The way that comes back around and you realize, oh, we're going to see the same sequence from multiple perspectives. The way it's accomplished is great. I love it. It's one of my favorite Tarantino sequences.
Brian?
It's good, yeah. I think it's the opening scene. Going from the plane to the airport to, you know, walking the escalator thing and through that hole and then customs and whatnot. Yeah. I love with no dialogue through the whole thing. I think this is obviously a low action kind of movie, especially for Tarantino, but that is some great camera work and just a very engaging opening 4 minutes or whatever to before we really even get anything dialogue wise or anything like that. It's very cool.
All right. Well, these last two questions about this movie in particular kind of go together. So first, favorite piece of casting. For me, it's Forster, no-brainer. It's awesome. Pam Grier is so close. She's so great. She's so awesome. But Forster's such much more of a random pull. But both are great. This is some of his best casting, I think, that he's ever done in here, other than probably Christoph Waltz fighting him out of nowhere. But yeah, it's so, so good. Kent, what about you?
Yeah, that's a great one. I would probably say either Chris Tucker.
Yeah,
because it's unconventional, and it showed Chris Tucker it worked can act.
With two
we've seen
three
beyond,
directors
beyond Rush Hour. He has another muscle that he can flex, which is unexpected. And
imagine Tarantino being the third creepiest director you've ever worked with. Not that he's that creepy, but you know, the feet thing and stuff. Like, I've been with Luc Besson and the Rat Man. Like, Quentin, you're basically Mormon, dude. Like,
breath of fresh air.
Yeah, you're just a good dude. Just enjoying hanging out.
He said, Chris Tucker said this was like the first movie he had been cast on that he actually had lines. Because he would just show up and they'd be like, all right, Chris, do Chris Tucker stuff. Here's the scene. Be Chris Tucker.
Yeah. Here's a Hong Kong detective.
You understand the words that are coming out of my mind. So he was, took him by surprise that he actually had good dialogue, you know. And my other one would be Michael Keaton. I think he's underutilized, maybe.
It's the last time we saw him for a long time, too, in a lot of ways.
But it's so perfectly cast for just the energy that guy needs to bring. And love it. I understand Nicolette's a big character in the Elmore Leonard verse. Mm-hmm.
I've heard that too.
Yeah, he's in, I mean, plays the same character in Out of Sight,
yep,
which is cool. Mm-hmm. And then that, I mean, Out of Sight was, I think, the next year, 98, right? And that's kind of it. We barely see Keaton for over a decade.
Yeah, after. So like The Other Guys is like the last time I remember being like, oh yeah, I love him. Yeah. Don't Go Chasing Waterfalls.
That's really cool. That's right.
You asked to make a McDonald's biopic. You do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, other than Shaq.
For me, just real quick.
Oh, yeah,
for me,
sorry.
The casting. Because these two things go hand in hand. Because you guys are both right. Pam Grier is incredible as well. I love Robert De Niro in this kind of role where he is just a part of the ensemble almost and is very reserved and sort of almost character actor-y and you just... And that's sort of, this is a weird answer to my casting, which, because I think this is a perfectly cast movie. I don't have anything to add on that. I wish that he would have done more of that, this kind of stuff. I wish he would do more.
He's rinsing off the heat a little bit of this, too. It's like slowly coming off of him before he goes into full Fockers mode 2 years later.
For real. I mean, like, it's after this, it's like analyze this and that and the meet the parents and all this kind of stuff. And then into a kind of a rough era of trying to still be kind of action movie guy and not totally having that same kind of
few divorces, you know. Tribeca Real Estate's tough, you know.
exactly
it's you gotta sometimes do a bad grandpa to cover your nut
for sure.
When you're squeezing off kids in your 80s, like, you gotta
right it's just very odd. Like, we've gotten back to a place now, like over the last decade, I would say, where De Niro has sort of reclaimed has had a great, whatever, if this is the last phase or next to last phase of his career, it's been done really well. And he's done a great job with it. There was a solid 10 to 15 year run where you're just like, man, remember when Robert De Niro was great? This is tough. 88 minutes or whatever. This is rough.
Yeah.
And then when you go back and you revisit this movie, you're like, gosh, he's really good at this. Mm-hmm. And he's really good at, like, priest role and Sleepers, you know? Like, these are things that he probably, and hey, you got paid, so whatever, but he definitely could have made this whole decade of his career be great, great character work and kind of low-key, smaller performances that would have gotten a lot of praise.
Maybe this one not
I would make the same decision. Give me the money. Don't get me wrong. I'm just saying.
Maybe this one not getting praise was his reason to pivot away from it, you know, where it's like the Adam Sandler theory of he tries real hard and then he's going to make 80 bad movies after that. And I think he wanted the role of Max Cherry, but Tarantino's like, no, trust me, Lewis is the guy for you. And then... Yeah, maybe not getting any recognition for that. He was like, I don't know. I can't do this. Can't do this ensemble.
He'd already cast Forster and De Niro wanted that role. And he basically told him, well, let me go think about it. And then came back and said, hey, I'm sorry. I'm going to stick with Forster on this. And then Tarantino was like, okay, cool. I'll do the other one. That's fine. And apparently didn't really love working with Tarantino, which doesn't totally surprise me. But it would be interesting. It would have been interesting if he would have popped up in more of these, because he's, I mean, I think some of this is him, some of this is the writing, and this is obviously a different kind of movie than a lot of other mm-hmm. Tarantino movies, but he works in this world. So, it, you know, what could have been if he didn't dislike it, you know?
I mean, the scene where he's explaining to Ordell that he had to kill Melanie is one of the greater sequences. It's like, well, if you had to do it, man.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. Yeah. Couldn't be helped, basically. Yeah. Yeah. So,
other than Shaq, any casting wishes on this one? Near misses or just kind of wild people you think would be better in any of these roles? Brian, you were saying Lena Dunham instead of Pam Grier, like 2012 Lena Dunham.
Right. Yeah. Think about how that would have changed the movie.
You're right.
Yeah, that's all I'm saying.
You're right. Any casting wishes from you guys? Charles Oakley instead of?
Might be controversial. Harkening back to last year's retrospective, Samuel Jackson's great in this, mm-hmm. but what if that was Denzel?
Yeah.
I'd love to see
that. Be cool. Yeah, I really want Denzel to be in this last Quentin really bad. That'd be cool. I just feel like...
That's a great call. Yeah.
That's a good one. Let's leave it at that, Kent. You win. You win that. All right. It all builds to this, boys. I will go first because I have my list in front of me. Jackie Brown is my fifth favorite Quentin Tarantino movie. What about you, Brian?
That's my spot too. It's number five.
Okay.
I love this movie. I will say mine is kind of a combination of favorite and best. For example, I think Pulp Fiction is a better movie than Jackie Brown, and I totally get its reputation. I like Jackie Brown more than I like Pulp Fiction still to this.
But you've got Pulp 4 and Jackie Brown 5.
Pulp
right?
is 4.
Yep. Correct. Yeah. And Reservoir Dogs 7. Kent has Reservoir Dogs at 4, Pulp Fiction at number 1. And Kent, where does Jackie Brown rank on your list?
It is 8th on my list.
There we go. All right. This was fun, guys. These are fun. And again, if you're not a subscriber to the Mad About Movies VIP feed, head on over to madaboutmoviespodcast.com/VIP and check out our VIP feed. We've got a few different subscription options for you there, annual, monthly, all that good stuff. So you can check out bonus episodes like this one every week, retrospectives every month. Lots of good stuff. Sometimes we just get on there and talk. We do our punishments on there whenever one of us messes up. It's all good in the VIP, and there's some great people in that Discord as well, and it is popping off 24 hours a day, so much so that it overwhelms me. Okay, until next time, guys, I'll see you in the VIP Bar Lounge Grill and at the cinema.